Welcome to the podcast. It's dedicated to making you a faster cyclist. The Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee, and with me today is our head coach, Chad Timmerman.
Hi, everybody.
And our CEO, Nate Pearson.
Hello.
And we are going to answer more of your coaching questions today. You can submit them to us using the hashtag AskTrainerRoad or just directly to us at trainerroad.com/podcast. So let's get straight into it today. Let's see. Well, actually, before we get into it, I should probably admit to you guys. So a few weeks ago, I told you my grand
Just
plan.
Just cut to the chase. Who was right?
Jonathan has a confession. Here it is.
Who was right and who was wrong?
Coach Chad was right. I was very wrong.
I think I was right too.
Yeah, you were too. Yeah. But here's what I'm getting at. Coach Chad is usually right. So and this is what I'm finding. Whenever I think I have this plan to so basically a few weeks ago I said I'm gonna train 3 times a day. Because we have a new baby in the home, splitting it up in between naps and everything else. I couldn't get out for an extended ride. And I figured I would try to chop up all that time that I do plan to spend training just into smaller chunks. And it wasn't working from a logistical perspective, but also I wasn't getting the improvements that I wanted to see. So all I ended up doing was just following our training plans, and that is working famously. Every time, that's like the...
I think 3 is way harder than 1. It's just the setup and tear down.
That was the hard thing was every time I would have a window, I'd be getting kitted or getting ready, and then the baby would cry, and I wouldn't be able to do it. Or it would get cut short because of that. It's just, it was really tough.
The pre and post actually adds up. So when you do it 3 times a day, that's quite a lot of time to dedicate to kitting up, suiting up, getting everything paired and turned on, and just making sure everything's as it should be. And then afterwards, you know, potential shower, towel rub, whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, because I was not just going to hang out in my kit and be ready all day. That's disgusting. So I just switched back to following a mid-volume plan. Things are going great. Yesterday,
which plan are you doing?
Long story short, big knee battle with a knee injury has put me way behind this year. I'm actually in sweet spot base still. So sweet spot base 1 mid-volume and following through on that right now. So... I'll be going into week 4 here soon.
And your FTP went down just a little bit?
After the injury? Yes.
I mean, I'm looking at your career right now. It looks like just since your baby's been born, you've lost 10,
no,
10 watts.
No, that shouldn't be the case. Let me look at that.
I see it 290 before, and now I see it 280.
No, so 290 is where it should be. Yesterday was the first day we're riding at sweet spot levels at a 290 FTP, actually. Felt a little more like tempo instead of threshold, which was good. So that's like I always love feeling that. And that's when I know I really need to hit it with consistency. And then I'll start to make some gains. So
is there a lesson here? I mean, were you trying to play catch up? Were you trying to cram because you felt behind? Is that what?
Basically, yeah. So I feel dreadfully behind because I've missed the whole entire mountain bike season, really, right?
So the lesson here is that you can't cram fitness, just like anything else.
Yes. And also trying to get creative with the schedule and splitting up training, there is a benefit to contiguous training that you simply can't get. Otherwise, it's really tough. So there are transformations that happen with your body and with everything else after a certain amount of time. And when you're trying to break it up into 30-minute chunks, you're not going to get the benefit that was intended with a 90-minute ride.
So what's your plan? So we're going to race cross. It's a big announcement. We just got new bikes today. John, why don't you tell them what bikes we got?
So we got Crux Expert X1s.
Specialized
Crux Expert X1s. They're the ones with like the charcoal gunmetal white and the little bit of pink.
Splash is a hot pink.
Yeah, Splash is a hot pink, which I'm not sure if I'm hot about the hot pink, but we'll see. So we got those. They're pretty solid builds, right? They have SRAM X1 on there, which was like a must for me. I didn't want to have to deal with a front derailleur. And I tested it out last night, went through rock gardens and a dirt jump line and everything else on it, and zero drop chains, no chain slap, any of that. It was quiet and silent. So
cross season starts in 1 month for us. Is that right?
A month.
Yeah, 2 months, I think, before I do the first race.
2 months? I thought there was September. Yeah.
Oh, good Lord.
Yeah, there's one in like mid-September or something like that.
Yeah. So what's your plan, Jonathan? Are you going to try to like focus on cross season?
Yeah. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to finish out sweet spot base 1. And then I think what I'll do is I'll actually take the first chunk of sweet spot base 2 and I might cut it in half and then go over to the cyclocross plan. That one I've followed. So back when the cyclocross plan, when we didn't have base build specialty, So for those that don't know, we break our training plans up into three chunks. So then you can easily kind of modulate your training plan, change things around so you can train for what you need at that time. But before, the cyclocross plan was 20 weeks long. It had a build built into it. And I followed that for mountain biking before we had a mountain bike plan. And my fitness was on point.
I think like, it was a complete start to finish plan.
Yeah, it was
20 weeks.
It was. And my fitness was through the roof. So I'm looking forward to going back to that cyclocross plan. My body responds to this type of training really well. So it's just for you guys. Oh, watch out. But I'm really excited to do that. So I think what I'll do is probably first 2 weeks of Sweet Spot Base 2, or I may just switch over to the cyclocross plan, depending on how I'm feeling, and then go into the cyclocross plan.
What about you, Chad? What's your goal? What are your goals?
You know, I kind of don't want to give that away just because a question later on. That's not what I mean. A question a little later on is very much in line with my reply. So rather than repeat that, let's wait for that question.
Okay. So what I'm going to do is I'm in cross country Olympic right now. I'm going to finish that. I have 6 weeks left. And then that will kind of bring me right to that first race. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm going to go right into mid-volume cyclocross if I feel not burnt out.
Yeah.
Hopefully I don't, right? That's what a lot of cross racers do, right? Is they get to the cross season and they're like, oh, I don't want to work out anymore.
That's what I've done every year, which is so let's let it be known. We are all new to this particular discipline. This is new territory. Yeah.
And kind of racing intensely into the fall. That concept is new to all of us.
Yeah. So this is gonna be educational.
That's true.
Triathlons go
pretty
late. Well, not super late, but
and really at any point, triathlons are going around. There's really no
it stops because of the cold water, but there's a lot of in California late. But you're right. I kind of only race until mid-October.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Same here.
Yeah. So it is going to be new for us.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting. We'll see. We'll see who's the first one to clip a barrier and go over the bars.
Oh, that'd be me. I'm just going to get on my bike, like where you jump and just fall.
Yeah. Yeah, no doubt. Yesterday, I bunny hopped up a curb. And I bought some really crappy pedals because we're waiting for some fancy ones from Expedo to come, some full titanium things. And I have some really crappy pedals, and both feet unclipped right when I went to go bunny hop up a curb. And I made it up the curb just fine because I try to make a habit of not pulling up with my feet when I bunny hop. I try to bunny hop properly. If I didn't have that technique, I would have munched a curb and probably lost teeth. It would have been so bad and really embarrassing too. So.
This is a preview of what's to come when Jonathan's on the race course.
We'll have to bring some cameras.
Yeah, no doubt, right? Yeah, we should all be running we have K-Edge mounts and you can run a GoPro underneath on there.
We should flip them around so we can see your face.
We should do that. So cool. All right, so let's get into it. Enough about us. Let's go into a question from Twitter, and he actually said this is a new Jens. So we've been accused of fabricating the name Jens or something, or just answering one person's question.
Just a lot of Jenses.
It's a lot of Jenses, man. So he says, how does one actually know that your heart rate zones are correct? I know that 162 is my power zones are correct. I know that 162 is my threshold heart rate for FTP. So I guess actually he is talking about heart rate.
I don't. Is he asking?
I think he's asking about power zones.
Let's cover both. Let's do power first.
Well, so first off, they're not zones, and this might sound like semantics, but Dr. Coggan specifically labeled these levels, and the reason behind that is he wants it to be clear that the levels overlap. So it's not like you go from one zone and then you're out of that zone and into the next zone and then you're definitively out of that zone into the next. Rather, these are all overlapping levels that bleed into one another.
It's not light switches, it's more like faders.
Exactly. That's a perfect way to put it. So we base everything on your functional threshold power. So that's our anchor for all of these zones. So assuming that you have a decent measure of your current fitness, which is, you know, in our case, FTP, functional threshold power, then all of these correlate to that. They're all based on percentages of that where we estimate those levels. And again, there's a lot of crossover. So just because, you know, you're riding at 85% doesn't mean you're missing out on any of the benefits that come with riding at 65% or even some of the benefits that come with riding at 90 or 95%.
Mm. And two, on our app, we call them power zones. Not
power zones. Well, they're generally, everyone calls them that.
And like I said, it could be argued that they're semantics. The point is you just don't want to lose sight of the fact that they all overlap. They all blend.
Yeah.
And then for heart rate with LTHR, I'm actually regretting that we ever put that in the app.
Mm-hmm.
The tests that we have for the FTP tests aren't really good tests to get LTHR. And then when you get them, the zones don't mean anything inside of Trainer Road. We tell you to ignore them. Well, so I know, but if I take them out, everyone's going to be like, oh, you're going to yell at me too.
Here's the difficulty with LTHR. Most people, when they look at heart rate zones, those are based off of your heart rate max, not your threshold. Yeah. That's how all heart rate zones are laid out, right?
Well, not LTHR, though.
Right, but when people are, I'm saying the point of reference that people have, when using heart rate for zones.
Take their age minus.
So they get it confused because with power, it's all based off of your threshold. But with heart rate, it's based off of your max. So when you're talking about the two zones, they're defined differently. They're totally different ways of
anchored
measuring.
Differently. Yeah.
I mean, we've gone into the differences between heart rate and power and the downsides of heart rate many times. But it's as far as if your zones are correct, that's the tricky thing about heart rate too, because your max one day to the, like, you do have a physiological max, but your ability to reach that max could vary greatly.
But in our app, we do LTHR, which is a percentage of your average heart rate during like a 20-minute test. Mm-hmm. And then we build zones off of that based on what Joe Friel. No, actually, that's a good point. It's Coggins' heart rate zones, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we just take what he has for those zones and put it in there. We used to get a lot of questions about, well, I want to edit my own heart rate zones and all that kind of stuff. But they've kind of gone away, and everyone's been like, yeah, just focus on power, which is what we should do.
We're a power-based training company anyways.
Exactly. And that's what if you've listened to a few episodes, we strongly recommend looking at. It's kind of like if you're racing and looking at RPMs rather than how fast you're going and trying to do everything off of RPM, it's not going to work.
No.
You're racing a car. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, racing a car. Yeah, yeah. If you're racing a bike, just pay attention to power. Cool. So hopefully that gives you an idea, Jens. I guess to just straightforward answer your question, if your zones are correct, they're constantly going to be in flux too, hopefully. You're training and you're going to be getting faster or slower depending on the time of year or what you're doing. So always fluctuating, but the intent is there. The principles behind levels of training with power should be what guide you. Cameron, at what point would you recommend starting a specific program? How much base should you have? I also use Training Peaks and my fitness score is about 16 just now. Is this high enough? Or would you recommend more fitness before specific cyclocross training? So somebody that's wondering, really probably new to the structured training game.
Yeah. So Cameron, we lay things out in a base build specialty format. So we subject people or encourage them to do a full 12 weeks of base followed by 8 weeks of build, which kind of, we've been over this. And then they specialize for another 8 weeks, totaling about 28 weeks. That assumes you have the 28 weeks, and it also makes certain other assumptions. Higher level athletes or athletes who have been doing this for literally decades may not need a full 12 weeks of base. The timing of your event may see to it that you can't have all 28 weeks and you have to prioritize. But typically, you want to have a decent foundation of your primary adaptations, a decent aerobic fitness, good strength, good skill, et cetera. Then you kind of fine tune that, and then you basically build your FTP is primarily what we're after with the build phase. And then you move into your specialty where you could just kind of fine tune it. Where you start again depends on how much time you have, how much experience you have. But typically it's 28 weeks if we can have it exactly the way we like it.
So when he says fitness score of 60, is he talking about CTL?
Yeah, I have a feeling he's measuring at CTL, and that's going to be relative to each rider. So, some riders can handle massive CTL. Some riders are starting out. In your case, it's 60. Next week, ideally, it's more like 65 and then 70, and you gradually ramp it up such that your fitness improves. There's a question on this later, and we'll address exactly what that 60 is. But
I'll fill everyone in really quick.
Let's jump into it, because that's actually the next question is a guy that's actually asking us about CTL, TSB, all these other acronyms.
I want to answer Cameron's questions too. Do you want to do Marco's and then jump back to Cameron?
Sure.
Let's do that.
Okay.
Yep. It'll give us some good context. So Marco asks, I've heard the terms CTL, TSB, and TSB mentioned in a lot of questions on the podcast, much like Cameron's right now, but I don't know what they mean. Could you elaborate?
Yeah, so I'll hit this first, and I'm sure Nate will chime in because he has a really good understanding of this stuff. CTL is your chronic training load. That's basically your fitness. That's something that we try to grow week by week by week. So it's in most cases, it's a six-week average, and we're trying to lift that average over time, which is a signification of your overall fitness. So if you can handle this much stress this week, then next week you can handle more. Then next week you can handle more. That's an upward trend showing us that you're handling more stress. You're becoming a fitter athlete. Then there's what's called your acute load, which is ATL. That's just your little microcycle, your week, how much stress you're doling out over the week. every time you increment that weekly load, it's going to drag your fitness up a little bit, ideally. But the difference between how much you're doing during that week relative to how much you did last week affects your stress balance. You know, how much can your fitness accommodate? How far are you pushing above that? That gives you a number that tells you, excuse me, that I've far exceeded my CTL and my stress balance is like negative 20 or 30, or I'm more in line with that. You know, maybe if you're tapering or coming close to an event or you've been sick or something and you're closer to zero or even positive.
Yeah. And so another way too to think about it, when someone says they have a 60 CTL, that means they've averaged for the last 6 weeks, 60 TSS per day. So
per week.
No, per day.
Oh, per day. No, you're right.
Per week
right.
Would be pretty easy to get 60 then.
Yes, it would.
So Cameron says that he's doing 60 TSS a day on average, which that's pretty high, actually. Like, 60 is good. And I think I've heard a lot of people who are like at the really top levels try to get to like 100. But just imagine, like, look at your workouts where you've gotten 100 TSS. Those are hard workouts. Like, that's a
if it's
90 minutes.
Yeah, if it's short, compact thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
tough. Or, I mean, you could get it from just riding like 2 hours easy.
Well, and see, that brings up a whole other point where the intensity of the workouts, I mean, relative 100 TSS of microbursts versus 100 TSS of 3 hours at aerobic endurance, very different.
That's why TSS isn't everything, right?
Nope. Doesn't
but
paint
it is
the whole
a
picture.
Good way. So if you're doing a trainer road plan where there are the structured intensity workouts and the endurance stuff, and it's kind of the same week to week, but there's just more of that, then you can kind of compare your TSS.
Yeah.
So that's right.
Well, yeah,
right,
and I was just going to say that you say 60 TSS, Nate says 60 TSS is actually is reasonably good. It actually is. It's back in the day, guys would compare. They'd be these high mileage riders who were doing, you know, 100, 110 TSS weeks. I'm doing 60, 70, 80 TSS weeks, and I would still go out. I'd have better fitness. I would beat them because the quality, once again, TSS doesn't paint the entire picture.
So Cameron, going back, says, what point should you recommend starting a specific program? He's got a CTL of 60, and he's going to race cross. So without knowing more about him, this makes me think that he hasn't done trainer plans in the past, but he has cyclocross season coming up. He could either probably do, depends on when the season's going to start for him, but what do you think, Chad?
Yeah, so low volume kind of pans out with that, with 60 TSS a week. So low volume would probably be a good place to start. It's a good place to start in most cases.
Do you think you'd start out with a base build or specialty?
Yeah, as far as when you start it, what's the timeline here?
He just says cyclocross season. So let's assume that it's 6 weeks and it starts.
Yeah.
Yeah, so if you have 6 weeks and you're, it depends where you're coming from. If you're starting from scratch, I would say take the first 6 weeks of either the sweet spot one or sweet spot base two, probably base two, since you're kind of pressed for time, would be a great place to start and then fold that right into your specialty plan.
Yeah, sweet spot base two, specialty.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, exactly. Cameron, good luck with cross season. We'll be right there with you. So, Sean, his question, he says, what is the best workout pre-century ride 1 week out? So I assume he's maybe referencing like a need to change or taper or something like
probably.
That.
Probably. So Sean, this depends on how much, and you know, we go back to that TSB, that stress balance, and whether you define it that way or you just look at, you know, how tired you are. It depends how much fatigue you're carrying into this. If you're somebody who only trains a couple times a week and, you know, they're short, intense workouts and you got maybe 3 days on the bike, basically following a low volume plan, then you can probably carry that right up to that century. Unless for some reason you're overreached and even those 3 days has kind of pushed you to a point where you know you need some rest, in which case you're better off doing very little over the course of that week and trying to gain some freshness and then maybe doing like a priming workout the day before. In the case of a century workout, that would probably be just something like 3x8 sweet spot workout, not terribly intense, but something that reminds your muscles of how to do a bit of work. And then, of course, if you're carrying a ton of fatigue into it, maybe you're a very high mileage rider and you've got a lot of fitness in the bank, but you haven't really unearthed it. You haven't backed off enough to let it rise to the surface, so to speak. Then you're probably not going to do a whole lot over that week. And that's that same scenario where you're more concerned with becoming fresh because you're not going to gain any fitness over the course of that last week. But back in the case of a low volume trainer, you don't really want to disrupt your training regimen just for a single event when you're not training that much to begin with.
So hopefully that should give you an idea. And also, depending on how familiar you are with the century and how intensely you're planning to ride the thing.
That's another factor.
You know, it could just be carry on how you're doing it. And you'd be surprised, especially if you're riding with a good group, how quickly 100 miles can go by. Mm-hmm. It can go by pretty darn quick and easily. So there's a lot of factors there, but I think we got you on the right track. John, He says, I'm following the high volume build phase training for Ironman Louisville. And I was wondering what the men, is that how you say it? Louisville?
I think it's Louisville.
Louisville. Right. So. Yeah. Okay.
I'm guessing.
Louisville.
Louisville.
Louisville Slugger.
Yeah. No. I was wondering if it was Louisville or Louisville. So
I say like the baseball bat, Louisville Slugger.
Louisville. Yeah. If we're wrong, John, correct us. Let us know. I was wondering what the mentality was behind the Wednesday runs, specifically the 1 minute reps or the reps in 1 minute intervals. I'm assuming it's to raise VO2 max and maximize time on feet, but this seems to contradict all the other training plans I've seen in the past. Love the show and look forward to hearing your answer.
John, the purpose behind those VO2 max run workouts is the same purpose behind the VO2 max bike workouts. And basically, yeah, we are looking to raise VO2 max. The higher level athlete you are, the more experienced, the fitter you are, the less easily those VO2 max gains come. And it's pretty much all about raising FTP. But for riders who are, or athletes, triathletes who are less fit, there's still quite a lot of room to grow that VO2 max. And it sounds like you and a lot of other athletes on these contradictory plans aren't exposing yourselves to that sort of intensity. And perhaps it's not doing much. Your VO2 max is kind of leveled off. You're not really challenging it. So that's the idea here. By working hard for these brief periods of time, you get all those adaptations that come with working hard. And I could run down the laundry list of the adaptations we're after, but they're all aerobic adaptations where we're trying to get your body to work at a higher level while metabolizing, you know, less overall sugar, being better at burning fat.
I'd say too, there's a lot of Ironman athletes who probably have never done VO2 max workouts because they think that, yeah, oh, I'm never going to race
work
at
that
this
hard.
Intensity.
Exactly.
So why
and
do it?
And that's the mentality. And that's backwards thinking. I mean, that if you've got a ton of time to train, that's all good and fine. Train a bunch and you'll get some improvements in your aerobic capacity. But even so, you microdose, you know, just little bits of this VO2 max work can have a surprising effect, especially if you've plateaued.
I noticed a huge improvement in my half marathon and marathon running pace when I would do 400s and 800s. I joined a weekly track session.
Yeah.
And we do 400, 800, you know, 245 or something, like repeating that, and then 400s half of that, and they were hard, but your body responds quickly, especially too if you're a triathlete who have never done any VO2 max. Yeah. It just, like, your body's like, oh,
body responds,
oxygen.
And so does your mind. I mean, when you get used to hitting it really hard for 1, 2, 3 minutes at a time, and you go back to sweet spot work, it's all relative. It's like suddenly, okay, this 12 minutes, 15 minutes, whatever you've worked up to, doesn't seem quite as demanding because your perspective has shifted a little bit.
Yeah, I want to talk about something else too that kind of bugged me. So someone in marketing, her name's Chelsea, and she's just getting into triathlons. And she talked about how she finished the race so strong and like sprinted at the end. She's like, I don't know why anyone else wasn't sprinting. And I was like, Chelsea, if you sprint at the end of triathlon, that means you did not work hard enough. It's like sprinting at the end of your 40K
yep.
TT.
Yeah, or surging at the end of an FTP test.
You shouldn't be able to.
Yeah, exactly. So, and how it brings back to this is that I found, especially if you're racing someone on a triathlon, let's say you're an Olympic distance and you got a 10K, about a mile out, or about maybe 2 miles out, if I'm going head-to-head with somebody, that's when I start to pick it up. And then like a mile out, I pick it up more. And then a half mile, that's where I have like, okay, I'm going back to training and doing this 800, and I'm going to go anaerobic. And I'm going to probably feel like, you know, the last step over the finish line is going to be completely hard. But you're running in there and you're trying to go as fast as you can for as long as you can.
And now, having done VO2 max work, you know you can do it. You know what it feels like. It's not anything outside of your wheelhouse. You can handle it.
A lot of those athletes too, whether it's a course feature or something that entices them to pace or to increase their pace or anything else like that, when you're unfamiliar with how your body responds to that type of work and that gets thrown at you in the middle of the race, that can throw off your whole race plan. And that's a hugely damaging thing to your race.
So. I've, you know, in a triathlon, so only one person wins, but in the middle of the race, you're always battling like some of the same people like throughout the whole race.
Yeah.
And being able to go hard like that from, you know, a mile out is kind of farther than a lot of triathletes. So they'll try to sprint the last 40, 50 meters, right?
Yeah.
Against you. But if you surge then, you can break wills and they will, you actually probably only have to run, if you push for the last mile, you probably only have to run really hard for the last half mile because you can break them within a quarter of a mile and get a gap and then just run at another pace.
That's just this is the same thing with when people are riding together in the mountains in the Tour de France and they're below 13 miles an hour. They're below any type of drafting effect. yet sticking with that group is still very valuable because there's a mental, the mentality that's playing there, and you being able to hold with those people or seeing them right away, that is so damaging. So if you can use that to your favor when you're, whether it's a triathlon, a road race, whatever it is, and when you go by those people, we were just talking about it. When you go by somebody and that person blows by you with a closed mouth and just looks totally calm, cool, and collected, and they're pulling away from you, it's defeating.
It's damaging,
so,
yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, Nate, I've got some questions really quick about triathlon stuff, if you don't mind. You mentioned track workouts, and you mentioned the distances that you work at. But do you work on form during those track workouts, and what are some different ones that people could do?
So,
because I'm a noob with this stuff.
Yeah, it's form. So there's like different phases of form, I think, for like a triathlete. One of the big things early on where people that get injured, it's just running at a high cadence. Mm. So around that like 90 beats per minute cadence. Mm-hmm. And what that will do is...
steps per minute.
Yeah, steps per minute.
Stride rate, yeah.
Yeah, stride rate. So it's really 180 steps per minute if you count each foot, but gotcha. It's 90 beats per minute. At first, I'm a tall guy. Everyone's like, "Oh, you got to take these big loping, like you know." Mm-hmm. I'm taking up like 3 yards in every step,
yeah.
And I kind of fly through the air. That's not as efficient because you're going to go up higher in the air, and your foot's going to land. Like as you're running, you're going to land more on your heel than on the midfoot striker or towards the ball of your foot, mm-hmm. which is more efficient, and you'll get injured more. Mm-hmm. So pretty much the number one thing that I recommend to people is to up your cadence. And if you're not a fast runner, you're going to take these little tiny steps and mm-hmm. it's going to feel really weird at first. You can listen to music. If you go on like Spotify or something, there'll be tracks at specific beats per minute that you can go to. After that, there's like the chi running. There's a whole bunch of different kind of thoughts on how you should run. But basically what I think of is, you know, you're sitting up kind of straight, you're leaning forward slightly, and as you run, your fists are kind of by your hips and running back and forth. They're not like closing up against your chest.
So I went to Chelsea's triathlon mm-hmm. and cheered her on there. And by the way, good job, Chelsea. I know that we just criticized your pacing, but you did a good job.
That was our first triathlon ever.
Yeah. She got lost. By the way, she got lost in the water. And we had no clue where she was. And then we saw these people with paddle boards like way off course, just like going by.
My triathlon plans include siding drills.
Yeah. She didn't do any of those.
Yeah, no. But she clawed her way back, so kudos to her. But I saw a lot of people running with their arms just so tied up to their chest. And then I contrasted that to like every picture I've seen of like Tim Don, Jan Frodeno, like all these really good triathletes. They have such like open chests. They have such broad shoulders. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Their arms aren't tucked up to them tight. They're relaxed. It's not as if their arms are flailing. Yeah. But
you look at Maka too. He does a really good job of that, of keeping his fists kind of next to his hips, and they're kind of swinging around there.
Yeah.
My wife does that. She kind of has one arm that kind of guards her chest. But you know, those are all I think marginal
super
and just
fine tuning.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Having the higher stride rate so that you don't get injured is like the number one thing.
Yep.
Work on that and get faster. And then when you get to like the more high level, then you can kind of tweak your stuff. But so many people, like they run, you know, 10 miles a week and they're trying to focus on where their hands are. I'm like, no, get up to run 40 miles a week.
Yeah.
Right. For like
before
6 months.
Before you worry about that.
So. Yeah. It's before you worry about all that little stuff.
I will interject one thing. It seems like a finer point, but man, does it make a big difference? Is a lot of people run with kind of folded hips. They're really closed and leaning forward rather than this tall stride that we're talking about where you're almost kind of falling forward. And whether you fall forward or, you know, reach with your head or lead with your hips, it doesn't matter. But that bend at the hips doesn't work for anybody. So, so open up those hips. The more closed they become.
Essentially, keeping your upper body more upright will do that.
Yeah,
correct?
Basically, any fold in the hips is pretty much working towards.
That's got
to
be tough
you.
With strollers. If anybody runs with strollers, the tendency to lean forward on that would get you into
Jonathan
that.
Jonathan knows now.
Yeah, I do. Yeah. So sorry to make this into the running podcast, but
we just lost 1,000 people.
I know. Come back, cyclists. I'm
between
sorry.
Music and running.
Chad actually
going
has
away.
A yeah. Chad actually has a shirt that he wears. It says "Running sucks."
Yeah.
It does.
Yeah. So. Welcome back, cyclists. Let's talk about cycling now. So, George, he says, regarding the ramp test, at what percent of FTP should or is a good point for a person to start after a warm-up, he notes? I believe it steps in blocks of 20 watts for 1 minute until you fall over and die with a smiley face.
So, George, these ramp tests, PPO ramp tests, MAP ramp tests, it's a big can of worms to open. Suffice it to say, there are many different protocols. You can do short steps, you know, maybe 1 minute steps. You can do 12-second very short steps. Ideally, they're long steps because what we're looking at is for your oxygen uptake to kind of level out. For you know, a minute or two, whatever, but that takes longer steps. So 3 minute steps, 4 minute steps, even 5 minute steps are going to be more representative of what your actual VO2 max, where it tops out, where it is. The protocols we have in the PPO group. So if you go to our website and click on the teams icon, you can see what teams are offered. And if you type in PPO group, you'll see some ramp tests. There's a 1 minute, a 2 minute, and I just added some 3 minute tests because those are kind of I won't say the gold standard, but they're utilized by more people. And all we're trying to determine is where does your power fall when your aerobic resources are maxed out? When you're taking in and utilizing as much oxygen as you can, where does your power fall? And where that is a good measure of your power at VO2 max. Correlate that with your FTP, and you can get a real good sense of, you know, how does your FTP, you know, how much of your VO2 max can you operate at? You know, what's limiting me? Is it my aerobic uptake, or do I just need to develop more endurance? And you can kind of decide, you know, which needs more emphasis. Commonly, athletes operate somewhere around 80% of their VO2 max. That's about where their FTP falls. Mm-hmm. And so you can kind of use that as a benchmark. See, am I even close to that? Am I above that? And maybe I need to start working on more VO2 max work, less. Either way, it can kind of help you steer your training a bit, but it's a little more high level than most athletes are looking for.
So what if you're operating at 70%, what would you do? What does that mean?
If your FTP falls at only 70% of your aerobic capacity,
yeah,
then you need to do a lot more endurance work, a lot more sweet spot, and basically build your muscle endurance. You got a big engine, but you're not utilizing much of it.
And that could be normally seen in people that are newer?
Yeah, typically.
Yep. And what if I was at 90% of FTP?
In that case, you're pressed right up against that quote-unquote aerobic ceiling. So it's time to, you know, maybe try to bump that ceiling up with some concentrated VO2 max work, like a VO2 max camp. Hmm. Wink, wink.
That could be... some of the reason too, where I have felt that sweet spot stuff has really helped me, and I'm pretty good at the VO2 max stuff.
Yeah.
And because I have not had as many seasons strung together, you know, I'll go for like a season and a half,
yeah,
and I'll have a kid, or a season and a half, and I'll start a business. Season and a half, and I'll have a kid. Yeah. Season and a half, and I'll have a kid, and take a season and a half off.
Right.
Which I'm not stopping this season.
Nice.
No more kids. Surgically impossible. Knock on wood.
Yeah, hopefully that doctor was good, right? Shannon, you mentioned that you take your Wahoo kicker to the races. How do you power the kicker? With a basic inverter, we have an Energizer,
yeah. So,
and I think it's a. Let me look up the stats right now. Nate, you go ahead and talk about it.
Yeah, so on Amazon, you can get them. They're little things. They're pretty much USB, and they have a 3-bolt plug, just like we have in the US, and you can plug it into a cigarette lighter, and it has enough power to power a kicker.
It's 12 volts, 180 watt.
Yeah,
by Energizer.
And how much is it?
It's $39 on Amazon.
Yeah, so that's pretty cool. You might think about an extension cable, because you kind of have to go right next to that door, and if you're parked close to other cars, you might have to go behind your car. Mm-hmm. So bring that too.
Yeah, and I keep my truck running when I'm doing the workout. I don't know if that's necessary.
I don't think so.
I've
never kept it running, and I've got two different cars now, both Audis. They both have a cigarette lighter. Well, that's not what it is, but it's in the back of the car also.
Yeah.
So for purposes just like
right
this.
Right out of the bed.
That's nice.
Yeah.
So, and then if you have like a truck, of course, and you can use like Tundras and Tacomas and stuff, we have an outlet in our truck, which is
not
nice.
Not Tundras? No.
Sad
day. That's a whole nother sad thing to talk about. But I have a Tundra and he has a Tacoma.
I know a lot of people are concerned about, you know, the inverter actually being able to support supply the kicker with enough power.
Yeah. 180 watts is enough. So look for that.
Yep. And that's enough. So you'll see another one on there that's 120 little guy. It's a little tinier, 120 watt, and that's $26. I just spring for the 40. You'll get more out of it.
So. Yeah, we don't know if the 120 is enough, but we know the 180 is.
Yes, exactly. So that's what we use. I know Team Sky has rigged something together with car battery or motorcycle batteries. Motorcycle batteries are so expensive. If you don't, they're like $160. So, they're compared to this little inverter, like that's definitely a better choice.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And I know Wahoo has said for a long time that they're trying to make it they're trying to release something that's going to make them remote, but I haven't seen anything actually come out for a while. So who knows? We'll see. Leon, I feel silly saying I love the podcast since that's what everyone says.
Don't feel silly.
It's great. Of
it's
course.
Natural.
And he says, of course I five-starred it. You're really padding you're stacking the odds in your favor, Leon. But I'm pretty sure I love it more than everyone else, though I have seen no signs.
That's what my daughter says.
And get this is awesome. He says, though I have seen no science to back that up. I love it when you guys say that. So my question: I bought and like the PowerTap P1 pedals. We've heard good things about them too, and we've had them here and had great experiences with them too. But it gives me a reading called pedal smoothness. We'll get into this. And I score there 20% left and right. My guess is that means my pedal stroke is not good. I did the form drills from your sprint try base plan, and I try to focus on the stroke quadrant, especially when trying to keep focus through the long 20-minute near FTP intervals. It helps pass the time to think top for a minute, down for a minute, scrape for a minute, etc. But what else should I do? Do I need to work form pedal stroke workouts into my training plans? Or maybe I don't understand what the 20% pedal stroke reading indicates. I'm sure your help will be valuable. Keep up the fantastic work, Leon.
Yeah, so Leon, surprisingly, I couldn't find any information on PowerTap's little help forum, but I did find something on the Garmin site that pegs pedal smoothness on average somewhere between 20 and 40%, or actually 10 and 40%. So you're right in there. As far as, you know, whether or not that's useful, that can be debated at another time, but all it is an average of, or it's an equation that takes your average power and your max power for each pedal stroke, multiplies it times 100, gives you basically an efficiency rating and tells you, are you really, really just jamming the pedals down or are you a little more fluid?
I'm usually 28 for a point of reference, Leon. Yeah. That's what my stages tells me. So it's trying to derive that. Who knows where that's getting that? I don't put any stock into that number. At least I should say it doesn't concern me. It's not like a metric that I'm tracking or worrying about or hoping to improve with my
training. Honestly, if you see you have a 5% pedal smoothness, you don't need a computer to tell you that or any sort of device to tell you that. You're going to feel it. Anyone, any decent coach or even fellow rider is going to notice it.
The big thing is if you, let's say, you focus your training on pedal smoothness and you make a huge amount of gains, I doubt that you'll actually see a huge amount of increase on the bike in terms of speed or anything else. That's the problem, right?
CompuTrainer spin scan since like the 90s kind of ruined everybody.
Oh, yeah.
And they think, I need to be spin scan. If you were 100% score on that, you would be a perfectly smooth rider. We've talked about in the podcast before, if you're totally knocking it and you're just, you know, this is like my wife first rode on a bike. You could see that she was just kind of mashing and didn't have the coordination to spin the pedals in a circular motion. Yep. And the drills kind of help with that, but it also kind of helps pass the time. I would not focus on those. I wouldn't even look at those metrics at all. Like we could show that metric if we wanted to, but we don't because we'll get questions like this. There's also been a study. This was back in the Lance doping eras, but I think it had Lance and a few other top riders, and they didn't spin 100% smooth. There's the first quadrant where they're pushing down with their quads is by far where the most power is recruited.
I'm not even sure I could lump in pedal smoothness with marginal gains. I don't even think it ranks that highly to qualify as this little 1% achievement.
It's worse, right? To like
that's another thing. It's like coaching someone's running to the point where you know it starts working against them.
Exactly.
I mean, these habits are very ingrained, and you can smooth them out a bit, improve them a little bit, but those changes kind of happen naturally. Especially, I mean, we have pedal drills for sure. We're still trying to teach people how to spin just a little bit quicker. Or how to do it a little more fluidly. We don't need to necessarily tie a metric to it. You'll know it when you feel it, and there are far bigger fish to fry.
Yeah, and if you are focusing on, or if you are dedicating a small amount of focus bracketed, much like what we have during our workouts, when you're doing those sweet spot intervals and you're sitting there for 12 minutes, so we're going to break that up and give you something to focus on, it's awesome. It's good, but it's not something that you should prioritize over anything else. I mean, just thinking about the Tour de France, like look at Ilnor Zakarin, he's
Filippo
the rider.
Pizzato.
Yeah. You look at a lot of these guys like Zakarin, he throws his body to one side of that bike into the next when he's pedaling. His pedal smoothness is probably really bad, but he won a stage of the Tour this
year. These are stellar riders
and
some
incredible.
Of them look awful.
Yep.
One thing that I do, if say it's a long interval, I'm in a race and my legs are burning, is I'll go back to these drills and I'll be like, okay, I'm going to like mm-hmm. kind of scrape for yep. like 20 seconds and yeah. it kind of relieves some of the pressure yeah. in my quads and I go back. Do you guys ever
absolutely.
Do that?
Absolutely. Yep. Absolutely. Totally. Yeah. yeah. When I
long
start,
climbs.
I put this in the text a lot when you're making it a little too quad intensive. And that's just mm-hmm. to say your quads are starting to light up. Try to shift the load off of them for just a little bit. Power doesn't go anywhere. Your attention gets a little bit distracted, productively so. And, you know, it can at least give you something to think about. Mm-hmm. But you can also, you know, alleviate
some of that. But then I go
back
to my quad. Yeah. Driven yeah. pedal stroke. I don't do the whole time.
That's what drives the pedal strokes. We're never yeah. not going to have a quad intensive pedal stroke.
Yeah. Yeah. yeah it's something tricky. And I think that power meter companies will always bring up little features like that as kind of like selling points.
Yeah, they
you
want
know?
You to buy it, right?
Exactly. They want yeah. to differentiate themselves. But just because it's a feature that's pushed and a feature that is very much there for the power meter doesn't mean that it's a feature that will make you faster on the bike or that it provides data that'll make you faster, right? So that's really just what we're concerned with is just that's why our interface and everything else is so distilled because we just want to make you faster. So we'll just have the stuff that matters there. And outside of the product itself, that's what we focus on. So, all right, Stu's question. He says, hi guys, really enjoying the podcast. I'm an avid listener and find every episode has really useful information. Thanks very much, Stu. That was nice. I'm currently in the middle of time trial season here in the UK. I race a 10 or 25 mile TT once or twice a week, but also do a couple of trainer road workouts each week too. At the moment, I just pick workouts based on how I feel, but would I be better following one of your low volume plans? If so, which one would be best as I want to improve my FTP but stay fairly fresh to race? Thanks for any advice. Keep up the great work.
Well, Stu, I'm sure you can guess. I'm definitely going to recommend following a plan. I think the low volume plans are a really good fit for someone who races frequently because it's just so easy to swap out a race for, you know, one of the existing workouts.
Or the junk rides that you may be filling in outside
exactly.
of that.
Yeah. yeah. And it's, if for no other reason, the structure just enhances your overall plan by in a lot of ways. And one of them is that the stress is progressive. So like we talked about earlier with that chronic load or that measure of fitness, you want it to escalate each week until, of course, you hit your recovery week and you let it absorb and then you start back and you continue to escalate. Unless you're figuring that out on your own, you might actually be missing that. Sure, you're doing workouts that might maintain your fitness, but I'm sure you're probably after fitness improvements. And it's a little harder to go about them when you just cherry pick your workouts unless you really know what you're looking for.
So what do you think you should do if he's doing, see the 25 miler, I'm like, hey, that's a pretty good threshold workout.
Yeah.
The 10 miler might not be enough.
No, I would pad that with some aerobic endurance sort of work. Unless, you know, you come home and you just feel like, you know, you're having a good day and you want to push it. Maybe, you know, you do one of those workouts on top of it, especially if it's just a 60-minute workout. You could probably get away with that without derailing things too much. But typically, those races are intense enough, even if they're short, that if you're going to do anything on top of it, I would just veer toward endurance mileage.
So if he's going to do three workouts a week, that extra workout would be endurance. What if he wants to do four or five?
The gains, I mean, it's kind of a...
Still TSS fillers, kind of?
Yeah, probably. I mean, anyone, more than 3 days of intensity a week, you know, one of those being just a 10-mile time trial is probably going to be more than most people can handle. Well, 3 days a week, a fair amount of people can handle that, but that's kind of the breaking point. Past that, the gains are so marginal or even diminished.
So maybe, too, if you want to work out more... I'm just going to come up with a scenario because we don't know what days of the week
right.
he's on. But let's say he has a Tuesday, Thursday time trial race, mm-hmm. and then he wants to work out 4 days a week on mid-volume. Saturday, he could do a 90-minute of intervals. Sunday, he could do endurance.
That's exactly what
And that's kind of – that would replace kind of the Tuesday, Thursday workouts on yeah. trainer road are usually intensity.
Yep.
And yeah. so if he has the workouts on other days – he could just flip that around, right? So that he has that 90 minute in there of right. intervals and then the endurance. But if he wants to do three workouts a week, drop the 90 minute or drop the endurance?
If he's a low volume trainer, I would say drop the endurance and focus on the 90 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's probably going to get more benefit out of that.
Right. This is a really common, by the way, Stu. I hope that, and for those listening that aren't doing 10 to 25 mile TTs, because I know that's a very UK thing, but outside of that, if you're racing, this is a really common way. In fact, I know this is the way I'm following my training plan right now, is how we just talked about how structuring it out and how I have my races and those replace certain workouts. And I'm sure Nate's doing something somewhat similar because he's been racing mountain bikes too. But it's a great way to kind of to follow a training plan and still work in your racing throughout the summer. Instead of just dropping off completely with your structured training, because you'll see your results drop if you do that.
And actually, I want to kind of further the point I just made. You said I recommended dropping off that long ride in favor of the longer interval ride on the weekend to a point. That's 3 days of intensity each week. And you might find, especially if you can make that long ride a truly long ride, like a 4 or 5 hour outdoor ride, 3 or 4 hour indoor ride sort of thing, the gains you're going to see from that, not to mention the break from intensity, can actually carry a lot of benefit as well.
And maybe too, though, if he has less time.
Yeah, if you're time constrained, you're going to have to go short and intense. That's just the way it is.
Yeah.
You're not going to get much out of an hour, 60% ride.
Could, if that 90 minute of threshold kind of workout is too much, could it go 90 minutes of sweet spot?
You can figure out, what exactly is beneficial or productive and what kind of starts to break you down.
That could actually, too, if he's doing TT work and the 90 minutes of threshold is too much, do 90 minutes or 2 hours of
sweet spot long intervals.
Sweet spot intervals, 20-minute sweet spot intervals, 85% especially for that 25-mile TT.
Yeah, that could be good. Position.
Did we cover specifically what plans Stu should follow? I don't know if we did. Perhaps we didn't. I missed it, but I don't believe we did. Because if he's considering which low volume plan to pick, which would be best for him right now, assuming it's race season.
If he's right in the midst of his season and he's got good fitness already, he could do sustained build, or he could jump right into the 40K time trial plan.
Mm. Awesome. Cool. And Mike, he says, I've got a 3-month cyclocross season. Us too. 3 months? I think we got 3 months.
Yeah.
Yeah, 3 months. Yeah. We're right there. At 3 month cyclocross season, I'm targeting an overall result in my local series. So he's not just targeting a specific race, but the whole series. Not just an A race near the end of my season. When do you recommend I complete the cyclocross specialty plan? From there, what do you recommend for maintaining fitness?
So I want to do the same thing, Chad.
Yeah. So this,
I think you want to, too.
This is
the question.
This is the question. Here's the big reveal. Here's what I'm hiding.
Chad, what are you doing?
I wasn't hiding anything. I was just wanted to address it at one time rather than two. I would recommend, I'm going to assume you're coming into this with some good fitness and that you're ready to start your specialty plan pretty much whenever. And that's kind of where I'm at. And I think that's where all of us are at.
Yep.
So I am simply going to start it with a 3-week season. I'm going to start it about 2 months or about a month from now. So I'll probably do 4 weeks of a build plan. I haven't really landed on whether or not I'm going to devise my own or use one of the existing. And then I'm probably going to do the mid-volume cyclocross plan with the intention being to, take that back. I actually, I thought about this a little longer. I'm going to start the cyclocross plan very soon, such that I finish with about 4 weeks of racing still to complete. At that time, in order to maintain fitness, that's when I'm going to start repeating either week 7 or week 8. And I recommend this all the time. That's because those taper weeks have enough intensity to keep you sharp when you're racing each weekend.
A good way to maintain your peak, right?
Exactly. You're not at that point trying to build any more fitness. You've kind of reached that peak. Now you're trying to hang on to it and maybe work on, whatever it is that you need to work on at that time. But it doesn't take a whole lot of work to keep your fitness. And over the course of those final 4 weeks, I'm probably dragging in a bit of fatigue already. If I'm not targeting a particular event and peaking for it, I just want to maintain. And a couple days, a Tuesday, Thursday sort of thing, then a Saturday race is really all you need, which is the cyclocross low volume plan.
So when are you starting your cyclocross plan?
I'm going to start right now. Yes, I am going to start right now because we have a 3-month season. I'm still wrapping my head around all this. But if we have 3 months and this is going to take me 2 months to get through.
It doesn't start for 6 week weeks plan, or a month?
I don't know. When does it start? That's what I'm saying. I haven't quite figured this out yet. But I will time it such that I still have 4 weeks of racing upon the completion of the 8 week cross plan.
So that's the important part. So then you'll just be aiming to maintain your peak for those 4 remaining weeks.
Yep.
Then after that, chances are you'll be ready to drop.
So ideally, I'm carrying a bit of fitness into it. So I'll start the season fit. Might not do too well because this is, like I said, new territory. But I'll bring good fitness into it. And then over the course of the 8 week plan, that fitness should improve to a peak, leaving me with 4 weeks to train. In which case, I'm just going to maintain it and try to race well.
It's actually September 24th is when the race starts.
Yeah, that's what I thought. It's more
and
like
then
2 months.
What's our last one?
Ooh, I think in December. Maybe the first week of December.
We just made this question all about us. I apologize, ooh, Mike, but hopefully this overlaps a bit.
No, I'm sure people are curious what Chad's actually going to do.
Yeah, no doubt.
But I am going to follow one of my already devised plans. I'm not going to make a new one for myself or build one on the fly.
So should I? So I'm in the cross country mountain bike plan mid volume, but all the cross country races are now over. Yep. Should I go back to build and then go into cyclocross?
I would. I'd refresh unless you're just really keen on ripping it and you feel like you can keep that going for, geez, two or three more months. That sounds pretty.
I'm enjoying the cyclocross or the cross
country. Guess,
yeah, the cross country mid volume. I'm enjoying it. It's like different types of intervals that I'm doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot to be said about variety.
I personally, as long as you feel like you physically are not getting fatigued, if it's mentally encouraging to you and it's motivating, that's a big factor.
Just worry they'll get.
I would try it.
But if my recommendation,
mid-September comes,
exactly.
Go,
that's the thing.
Yep.
Yep.
I would try to find a 2-3, maybe even 4-week period in there where you're doing something that it can still be plenty focused, but I would kind of tone the intensity down for a while. Probably just a couple weeks in your case.
Yeah, I could even maybe I'll go through it a little ways and then do 2 weeks of like sweet spot where it's kind of a lot easier.
Yeah.
And then go into cyclocross.
That's my go-to. Anytime I still want to keep fitness, I still want to do a bit of work, I always veer back toward sweet spot, something in there, pluck out a couple weeks.
Here's what I'll do. I'm going to go through some more of this plan that I'm enjoying, the cross-country mid-volume, and then I will do... Once I feel like my FTP has raised a bit, but before the season starts, I'll do an FTP test, hopefully have a new higher FTP, maybe 2 weeks of sweet spot, and then go in the cyclocross plan.
Hmm. Sounds solid.
Yeah.
And make sure, you know what we have to do too, is talk about DEXA, but I'm eating to maintain rather than eating to cut.
Hmm. Mine's on Tuesday, by the way.
Yours on Tuesday?
Yep.
Okay, I'm almost time for another DEXA.
I missed one.
You've been dragging.
I know.
Okay, so next week we will say... What the DEXA results are.
Yep.
But
DEXA number 3.
So, do we answer the question?
I feel like we did.
Yeah.
When do you recommend I complete the cyclocross specialty plan with 4 weeks remaining if you have consistent racing?
So, if you're not looking to peak, yeah, exactly.
Yep. And I've noticed that maintaining that peak for 4 weeks is usually sustainable. After that, it gets pretty tough to stretch it out any longer than that. For me personally, it's going to vary for each person, but
it also depends on how much you're training. If you're doing just a couple days a week and a race on the weekend, you can drag that out for 4 weeks, I'm sure of it.
Yeah, yeah, no doubt. David, he says, hi guys, podcast and product are great as ever, and thanks for answering a question or two of mine in the past. Here's one to follow up on a topic you've discussed recently, fasted training, and maybe of relevance to the new dad. Congrats to Jonathan. Thanks, man. Appreciate it. I get the theory of not doing high-intensity workouts fasted, but my weekday schedule and family life only allows for a 0-30 wake up and ride. I've been doing Tuesday and Thursday hard workouts, he's finishing the general build mid-volume plan right now, with one espresso. Can't recommend an espresso machine highly enough for this.
We have one in the office.
We do.
We use it.
And a half PB&J about 15 minutes before I get on the bike, and I have no stomach problems with this. I'm not trying to lose weight, rather to maintain weight. I'm currently 5'6 and 135 pounds, and my goal is to build power for cross. Is that still fasted training in effect? Not enough nutrition and not enough digestion time for it to matter? If I'm completing the intervals consistently, is this approach okay? Or is it a case of marginal gains where I'd be getting even more benefit from the same workouts with more complete nutrition and timing?
David, first off, I don't think you're, in the true sense, yeah, you're continuing your overnight fast by skipping breakfast, but you're not really in a depleted state, which is what I think the two kind of get confused. Fasting, is not eating, but depletion is where these quote-unquote fasted rides actually have benefit. So you're not coming into them depleted. You've got muscles that are stocked up from the night before, and I know this because you're getting through 60 minutes of high intensity. Your PB&J is not doing much for you. I guarantee that's not in your system 15 minutes later, not productively. So the fact that it's not upsetting your stomach is great. You can keep on eating it, but I'll tell you right now, you don't need it. I'd save it for after.
You don't think any of the sugar from the jelly
for sure,
by the end of the hour, like, so it's an hour and 15 minutes.
Yeah, the jelly, for sure. But the peanut butter is gumming up the works. I mean, that slows things down.
Yeah, actually
and then the type of bread you're having, if it's whole grain type stuff, it's going to metabolize slowly. Yes. If it's white bread, it's going to metabolize quickly. So that affects it. All I'm saying is you don't need it. Maybe those last couple of minutes are mildly benefited from having a little bit of jelly, a little bit of sugar in your system, but I'd be willing to bet you can still get through it and still do it with the same productivity, which the other part of your question, if these workouts are working, I don't think you need to change anything. There's not a big fasted benefit coming from this, though.
Yeah. If there is, if you are looking at different fuels, perhaps going with something like a gel, if your body handles that, or something that's just
a drink, really, if you got 15 minutes, you want to get it in there quickly, I'd make it liquid.
Straight up fuel. Get it in quickly and let it be absorbed quickly.
Yeah, but you don't need it. You've got enough in your muscles. You're getting through them already. I think you're just basically throwing gasoline on a fire that's already rolling.
Yep. I've been using the fasted training techniques so far for a while now, and I've been dropping weight too. So I was at 144 the other day, which is good for me. So dropping lower. Nate, your face.
You're a skinny mini.
So, but it's been working really well. And I've been following, actually, I've been getting up and then I have baby duty for about 2 to 3 hours, which is a long time. Yeah, sorry, Chad. Yeah, bad pun. I have for like 2 to 3 hours. And usually when you do fasted training, it's usually you get up and you get on the bike. But for 2 or 3 hours, I'm not taking in anything. And then I'm getting on the bike and doing my training. Now, I don't feel deprived, or I'm searching for the word and can't find it, but I don't feel as if I'm, you know, depleted or anything else coming into the ride. I feel just fine. And I do feel that I'm getting the benefits. I've noticed my reliance upon sugar over the past 3 weeks has dropped dramatically. Yeah. I feel like I need it less. It's really good, really effective.
I'm going to disagree with Chad here, and I think that the half PB&J is helping and being absorbed into your bloodstream.
Oh, yeah.
I think that if you measured, yeah.
I just don't think it's necessary. I think you'd probably have the same quality workout without it.
You could just try it once, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I don't. And I don't think, too, it's hurting anything.
Yeah.
So, no. And if weight loss is not a concern and it's not for you, mm-hmm. then and your stomach is abiding it, there's no, you know, gastric distress of any sort, you're fine to eat it for sure.
Yeah. For me, if I had a PB&J before I'd ride, I would get a rock in my stomach and nothing would happen.
Yeah. But David, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, cool. Let's move on to Alan's question. He says, hi, I've started racing this year in Ireland A4. I don't know what A4 means, but I assume it's a region of Ireland. So I found it tough going at first, getting dropped in the early races in March. But as the season has progressed, I've been able to stick with the pace until the end. I've even found myself in the top 15, around 100 to 150 meters before the finish line. However, that's where my problem starts. I don't seem to have enough kick or power to sprint past anyone. I have a power meter, and I can see my jump out of the saddle is around 700 watts, but it falls down to 400 before the finish line, and I'm always wasted crossing the line. So my question is, how do I fix this? Do I simply need to train sprinting more on my own, or do I hit the gym over the winter? I currently weigh 69.5 kilograms with an FTP of 255, targeting 64 kilograms and an FTP of 270 next year. Thank you. Love the podcast. 5 stars.
So I wonder if that A4 is a race categorization.
That's perhaps what I was thinking.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you're new to racing, then you're already off to a good start in that you're positioning yourself well. You're coming to the line in a position to sprint. So half the battle's won. Mm-hmm. Now, in fact, more than half. So now you just got to deliver on your sprint, which you don't have much of one right now. Starting at 700 watts, relative to where everybody else is, I don't know if that's good or bad, but the fact that it plummets to 400 before you hit the line says you're either starting way too soon or you just don't have staying power at that high sort of output. I'm going to assume that's it, and you just need to improve your sprint power. And sprint power, it doesn't always need to be about a snap. It doesn't have to be trained outdoors. It doesn't have to be this big explosive thing. Plenty of sprinters win sprints by maintaining power. They may not have a big jump, but they can keep those watts high all the way to and across the line. So you just need to decide what sort of sprinter do you want to be. Do you want to jump away from each other, from everybody else, and then hold your gap, in which case you need explosive power, or do you just want to be able to hold that 700 watts all the way to the line? And that's what I'd recommend.
I'm thinking of Travis McCabe yesterday in the Tour
exactly
of Utah.
Exactly why I'm thinking it, too.
Long sprint.
That guy just powered and didn't fade. Yep. So, you just
determine.
He probably didn't
hit his peak, right? Like when he launched, who knows? But
yeah, who knows?
What he did effectively and very well was maintain a high level of power for a long time.
And that's it, too. So even the riders with the strongest jump have to maintain a high level of power post-jump. Yep. So let's not even worry about the jump just yet. Worry about maintaining your power. And how you do that is just, what you need it to be. Is that a 30-second sprint? Is that going to be a long 40 or 51-minute long sprint, that's what you need to train. I don't know what plan you're on right now, but you need to mix in some of those efforts. Yeah. There are plenty of things you can do outside. I feel like maybe we discuss that another time. I don't know how much
time we have left. Yeah. We can discuss it again.
Yeah, yep. Let's do it.
Okay, so inside, try to improve your short-term power. What that is depends on, again, how long you plan to sprint for. Probably, I would work on 30-second and one-minute repeats and lots of rest in between them. So where you can really gut yourself, rest well, you know, 3, 4, 5 minutes, do it again. Keep the power high the whole time. Try to improve that fatigue profile you're seeing. As far as outside, you're just trying to, and this kind of goes in line with lifting weights in the gym, and whether or not you want to do it in the gym, whether or not you want to do it on the bike, at some point it has to be on the bike. You're just trying to recruit a lot of muscle fiber. That's high force repeats. So I like to do standing starts where I dump it into a big gear and I start from a near standstill and I just mash those pedals down until I get up to, you know, 80 or 90 RPM, rest well. Again, full rest, 4 or 5 minutes. Do it again. Each time should be highly productive, highly powerful. That's what's going to wake up those fibers that you're going to ask to power yourself for 700 watts over those longer durations. Mm. That's one of many drills that'll work for cultivating a sprint.
And sorry, Alan, but 700 watts peak.
Isn't that high?
It's not high.
No, it's not. But I mean, if he's racing, maybe A4 is his equivalent to our Cat 5, in which case a 700 watt sprint
might be good.
I think it's not good, but it might be enough if he could keep that 700 watts for 30 seconds. Well, 20, 15, whatever.
My point is that that number will probably need to go up, especially as you go forward. And two, you think like a lot of the race, especially in lower categories, it always ends in a sprint. And you're like, oh, I need to be a sprinter. I need to be a sprinter. Mm-hmm. Your body might not be made to be a sprinter. You might
be a 1K to go, 5K to go type of guy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Play with some breakaways.
Yeah. Don't think that you have to be a sprint. And the sprinting is more dangerous.
It's not a bad thing to have that snap, to have that capability. I mean, it carries to other realms.
Well, what's your guys' max power for sprinting?
Yeah, so I'm. So you said that. Let me figure out my weight in kilograms really quick.
We're not going by kilograms.
I don't know.
The two big guys here are talking about.
He gave his weight in kilograms, so I want to be friendly to him.
He's 41 pounds.
There's your snap, like your initial biggest number you'll see on your power file.
Yeah.
Then there's your 5 second, and then you can see how it degrades from there. Mm-hmm. But I've jumped at 1800 watts, and then I can hold 5-6 seconds at 1400 watts. But these are like dead fresh. I'm doing drills. I don't have any miles in my legs from that day.
And Chad's when a it big comes guy
to,
too.
Yeah. When it comes to sprint time, if I can muster, 800 or 900 watts and, maybe like an initial 1,000 plus jump that lasts all of a second, if that. But then if I can keep it, above maybe even 900 watts, I stand a real good chance of hanging in there.
My max is 1,400, but I can hold my max. I think I've held like 930 watts for 30 seconds.
Yeah, that's good. That's big.
Yeah,
that's
really Josh.
Rennie?
No, not Josh Rennie. And Jeremy. Anyways.
Jeremy Holbe.
Yeah, and he's a pretty fast guy. But
that's a legit sprint, but that's a long sprint with a lot of power.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I wouldn't consider that even. That's why I like to go more like 1K to go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's more my kind of thing.
So I don't fit the profile. Like if you see me, I look like a pretty slight guy. I'm not a muscly sprinter or anything else like that. But I'm actually pretty good in the sprints.
Good snap, though.
Yeah. So my kick, the highest I've had is 1380 watts. That's the highest I've hit. In a sprint, I should say. And then usually I can't maintain quite as high. I'm lucky to hold 800 watts for a sprint, and that sprint's going to be pretty short. We're talking 15 seconds.
Yeah, and that's what it's about. You have to see, how long do you need to hold this sprint? I mean, if I have an 1800 watt snap, that does nothing for me if I can't hold, if I'm going to sprint for 20 seconds and I start at 900 and I finish at 500, well, what's the point of that snap? It meant nothing. So you have to address, learn, I can sprint at this wattage for this long. So I'm going to wait until the 200 meter line or the 150 meter. I'm going to set a rock up at our local crit. So I know this is where I go. I go any sooner than this, I'm going to blow up.
And one thing to keep in mind. So when I launch hard or when I start a sprint, I should say, I don't necessarily shoot for that everything I possibly can, try to blow my kneecaps off type of pushing really hard.
Yep.
I start out my sprint, and I'll start it hard depending on where I'm at. But remember that drafting is in place here. Chances are if you're sprinting, someone else is drafting off of you. if you put out a massive effort, and let's say that 1800 watt spike that you put out, that you develop, just completely depletes you and makes you pretty exhausted, so you can't maintain something quite as high later on. If somebody's drafting behind you and you're falling off, it's going to be easy for them to get you. But if you start that sprint out and you don't just go for the moon right from the get-go, but you start out pretty hard and then you try to continue to hold that, it's going to be a lot harder for that person a lot of the time to get around you at the end.
Yeah, so Alan, there's a whole lot of strategizing that can go into planning a sprint. So you just kind of have to decide what type of sprinter you want to be, if you want to be a sprinter, and then kind of work from there. But it can get pretty specific. It doesn't have to be, though. It can be just a general, do what? Can I create a lot of power for a brief period of time and hold it at the end of a race? It can be that simple.
And when you practice sprinting, please look forward.
Don't look down.
Yeah,
stare at their wheel
down, and that's who you get these huge crashes where people get ruined bikes and stuff. Look forward.
Yes, and what I've noticed too, when people look down, they're usually like, and you want to have your back and core very much engaged, of course, but they're usually putting a huge amount of tension to their back. They tend to be the guys that pull their wheel up when they sprint too, because they're pulling down on those bars. They're lifting up with their back. They're looking down. They're really arched. If you look at Cavendish and Kittle, it looks like that somebody like glued a paper face onto them. And like, it's just like staring straight ahead. Mm-hmm. It's pretty amazing when they do that. It's really important.
You might lose like 50 watts on your sprint, but being able to get behind someone and be in the right position will more than make up for those 50 watts you lost.
Yeah. I'd say that the majority of sprints a good chunk of sprints that I've lost many times are due to positioning, and a guy either slows down in front of me and I need to swerve or something like that. Because I'm looking, I don't hit them. But if you're looking ahead, you can, in many cases, avoid those things, and maybe you don't have to lose that sprint. So, you know, one thing that I was thinking of too, like Nate, you mentioned, in most cases, everyone thinks they want to be at the end at the sprint in these earlier categories.
Yeah.
And Alan, you may be exhausting yourself trying to get into that top 15. Mm. I find that a lot of the time, just to get in the money to that sprint, you can do what you need, but if that exhausts you beforehand, then you might not be in a good spot. So
yeah, that's yet another aspect of sprinting, is how much juice do you actually have left when it comes time to sprint?
Yeah, and if you can learn to ride with the saying across the world outside of riding is always be the worst person in the room, right? Whatever you're doing. And if you can ride with smart, intelligent riders that are okay with riding with you, and you can see how guys, like, look at the P1-2 crit, look at the fast guys, and see which rider is just very good at moving through the field. And if you can pick up some tips from him on how he strategically moves through the field, so then when he gets to those final 150 meters, he isn't as exhausted, that could be really helpful.
Yeah, some of the better sprinters who jump out of it and end up winning the races that I've been just tearing my own legs off in, I don't see them the whole race. They're not in any of the moves. They're tucked in. They're smartly moving through the field. They're conserving. I don't even know they're out there until they come and win the race.
There's a whole, if you haven't heard it before, go back and listen to the Cliff Bar podcast episode about crit tactics, and that will really help you get to the end of the race fresh. And I'm just going to say it again, too. You don't have to be the sprinter. Like, the only time I will sprint is if it's like a breakaway sprint where there's like four of us or something.
Yeah.
And then that's really fun. But man, sprinting with all those people, I'm probably not going to win. I'm not really training to sprint because I feel like I'd rather just try to raise my FTP for all the other type of racings that I do.
Yeah.
Like,
you can win far more races with a big FTP than with a strong sprint.
Yeah. If you want to beat these sprinters, these specific sprinters, just make the race hard with 10K to go. And then that's going to make it really tough for them.
Yeah.
So, that's a good way to do it. So, cool. That covers it for this week. Thanks for submitting your questions. Once again, you can do so at trainerroad.com/podcast, or you can use the hashtag AskTrainerRoad. We comb through as many questions as we can. If we don't get to yours, we apologize, but we get a lot of them. This week, we got over 120 questions just through that /podcast form. So as you can see, it's quite a lot. But we will pick through them, pick as many as we can to answer, and hopefully we get to yours. Thanks for listening. Happy training, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.